Thanks for joining us. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, the human capacity for genocide, racism, and cruelty, and how and why we dehumanize. David Livingstone Smith is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of New England and the author of Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. He joins me in the studio. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-399-3566, email to talk@mpbn.net, or post comments on our Facebook page. David Livingstone Smith, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
First of all, what does it mean to dehumanize?
Well, dehumanization is a word that's used in very, very different ways. Sometimes we say people are dehumanized if they're degraded or they're not treated respectfully, and so on and so forth. I mean something very specific by dehumanization. I mean conceiving of others as though they were subhuman creatures. That is, conceiving of others as though inwardly they're not really human beings but some other sort of animal that it's permissible or indeed obligatory to kill or harm.
So in essence, it helps us to bypass our conscience?
Precisely, yes. We human beings do have very deep inhibitions against harming one another. You wouldn't think that from what you see in the movies, say portrayals of combat in films and so on, where people kill one another quite easily. But as a matter of fact, unless you happen to be a sociopath, it is very, very difficult psychologically to take a life of another human being. And I think there's a long story to explain why these inhibitions, these moral reservations are so deeply ingrained in us. But the consequence of this is if we wish to harm another human being, if for some reason it's advantageous to us to kill another human being, we can disable these inhibitions through conceiving of that human being as less than human.
So you would argue that we're sort of hardwired to have this conscience of feeling bad about harming or killing each other. It's not something that's taught. It's hardwired into us.
I try to avoid the term hardwired because it can be a misleading metaphor. But I would say this. It is something which I think is deeply ingrained in human nature. It's not simply something we are taught. And as evidence of this, many of the things we are taught we should do or we should refrain from doing are very easy to violate. You know, we're taught not to steal, but we, surprising number of people, cheat on their income tax, for instance. People are taught that committing adultery is wrong, yet adultery is rampant. Killing seems to be in a different category. Although we're told killing is wrong, for some reason, that has a very, very powerful grip on us. So it's not simply learning.
But we seem to do – there's a lot of killing for a species that has this reluctance to do it.
Yeah, well, there are two sides to the picture. And this is something a lot of people have difficulty understanding. We like to imagine that human beings are all of one piece, whereas in fact we have antagonistic forces that strive within the human soul. So although we have a horror of killing, which is universally acknowledged, we also have a certain fondness for it, and we have a fondness for it because there are many circumstances in which it's advantageous. If you want to steal someone's stuff, if you want to abscond with their resources, as human beings have striven to do throughout our history and our prehistory, or if you want to exploit their labor without recompense, then acts of aggression are deeply attractive.
But in order to justify those or to make us feel okay with doing that, we then dehumanize.
Yes, that's right. By dehumanizing, we give ourselves a solution to the problem of our own reluctance to commit these immoral acts.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. You make reference in the book about throughout history of humans being recategorized as animals, for example, as one form of dehumanization. Why animals? Is it because they're lower on the natural order?
Well, we imagine they're lower on the natural order. Dehumanization involves two fundamental psychological tendencies. One is to distinguish between how something appears and what it really is, between appearance and essence. And by making that distinction between appearance and essence, we can explain how it's possible for someone to conceive of one another, say, as a vermin, even though that other looks human. So the idea is, although they look like a human being, inside where it really matters, they're not really human. They have a non-human essence. Now, the other dimension, which is what you're gesturing towards, is this idea that the universe is arranged as a hierarchy of value, from the most perfect at the top of the hierarchy to the least perfect at the bottom. Traditionally, this was known as the great chain of being idea. And traditionally, of course, God was placed at the top and inert matter was at the bottom. And we, modest creatures that we are, placed ourselves just below God or just below the angels. And latterly, since the death of God, we are inclined to place ourselves at the very top.
And well above snails.
Yes, well above snails. You see, by definition, anything beneath us on the hierarchy, anything of lesser intrinsic value, is subhuman.
Are there there are cases then throughout history where these animal images were used in the course of dehumanization to justify major acts against humans?
Yeah, I think it's deeper than to justify. It's to facilitate. So if you really come to believe that another population of people is subhuman, that if you come to believe that members of this population are inwardly non-human creatures, and this is quite important, creatures that deserve killing in some way, dangerous predators, traditionally unclean animals, or creatures to be hunted for sport, then this liberates the aggressive impulse. It not only takes the foot off the brake in that we lose our moral inhibitions, but it motivates us to go after these others and commit terrible atrocities against them.
The one genocide that probably comes to mind in recent history is, of course, the Holocaust, where this played out.
This was quite explicit. In 1942, there was a Nazi publication under the aegis of Himmler's SS, and it was called The Subhuman. It was quite explicit, and it described subhumans, which were epitomized by Jews. The Nazis tended to think of everyone whom they didn't like as Jews, and this was a prelude to the invasion of the Soviet Union. And yes, they were quite clear about this. Jews and other so-called inferior races were not human beings. They were dangerous subhuman creatures. And in fact, the Nazis thought, as perpetrators of genocide virtually always think, that they were performing a great moral service to mankind by exterminating the Jews of Europe.
And of course, much has been written on this subject, but not a lot, you discovered, has been written about dehumanization going back thousands and thousands of years in human history.
Very little is written about dehumanization per se. I found this extraordinarily surprising when I began researching this book, because the term is used so frequently both in the media and in scholarly publications. One would think there is a massive literature on such an important topic. It's widely acknowledged that dehumanization plays a very important facilitative role in war and genocide, but if you look at the literature, it consists of a few dozen papers by social psychologists. That's about it. So in writing Less Than Human, I had to do an immense amount of research in a number of fields to try and, for the very first time, pull all the information together that we find in works of history and political science and philosophy and psychology and so on.
What were some of the earliest examples that you found?
Of dehumanization? Well, we can go back to texts written by the ancient Egyptians 3,500 years ago, roughly, in which the pharaoh brags about subduing various tribes in the region, and he characterizes them as animals. Mesopotamian literature of around the same period characterizes, again, enemies as subhuman beings. And we find the similar pattern amongst the ancient Chinese. So we're really going back very, very, very far. It's very, historically, it's a robust phenomenon. And it's also cross-culturally robust. That is, we find it not just in the developed world, but throughout the world, in indigenous cultures throughout the world.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. What about race? You mentioned it's cross-cultural, and yet we see race at the center of so many of these acts and conflicts.
I argue that race is a necessary feature for dehumanization. Racism is. But in order to understand that, it's important to have an appreciation of what is meant by this. So when we think of race and racism, we think of the races as they're conventionally distinguished in American society today. But if we look historically and cross-culturally, there are many, many other racial constructs. 150 years ago, the Irish were a race, Jews were a race, Poles were a race in this country. Indeed, the race problem was seen as a problem involving immigration from Europe. So what is a race? Well, the notion of a race is a notion of a human subpopulation that is supposed to be set apart from others. There's supposed to be some deep difference, some essence that characterizes this subpopulation and sets them apart. And this is the first stage of dehumanization. So we take some population, as, for instance, the Hutus did with the Tutsis in the most recent Rwandan genocide, the 1994 genocide, and imagine that they are fundamentally different. There's a deep difference that sets them apart, them apart from us. The next step is to imagine that deep difference, that imagined racial essence, of course there is no such thing, but that imagined essence is in fact a subhuman essence. So they're not really people after all. They're not really human. They are animals in human form.
And you would say history shows us that any race is capable of this. We often see it's whites and, you know, regarding all other, you know, races as subhuman, but this happens.
Regrettably, it's incredibly widespread. Yes, incredibly widespread.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. Email talk@mpbn.net or give us a drop us a comment on our Facebook page. Our guest is David Livingstone Smith, and his book is Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your questions and comments, again, talk@mpbn.net, Facebook comment page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, what the death of the mysterious dictator of North Korea, Kim Jong-il, means for the region, China, and the U.S.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this afternoon at 2 o'clock. As you know, many businesses in and around Maine join listeners in supporting various public radio programs on the MPBN radio service. To learn how your business can benefit from supporting public radio programming, visit our website, mpbn.net. Click on Business Support to find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information. Or you can call us at 1-800-884-1717 and ask for Susan Tran. And thank you for your support of public radio in Maine.
And welcome back. This is MPBN. I'm Keith Shortall. Today on the program, a discussion about the nature of humans. And we as a race are sometimes able to inflict great cruelties on members of other races and those fellow members of our species. Join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-399-3566, email at talk@mpbn.net, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. And we're going now to the phones, and a patient Fred calling from St. George. Fred, you're on the program. Hi.
Hello. I am recently studying the Course in Miracles. It's a rather recent piece of work by two people, and I find it very helpful in to deal with what's going on in the world. Let me give you the core of it, which is in one sentence. The aim of the Course in Miracles is to remove the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. That's in the introduction. And it's in the framework of Christianity, God, Jesus. And the Course does not ask me to believe anything. It asks me to read, to learn, and to experience. And it came along just the right time for me, and I'm very happy that I've been connected with it.
Okay. Do you have a comment on what you're hearing on our show today?
I've done a lot of reading since I left school and listened to the news regularly. Thank you, public radio. And, the Course says that you're either coming from love or you're coming from fear. Those are the two, the quote, polarities of what's going on with us human beings here on Earth. And to the aim of the Course is to remove the blocks so the person can love and be loved. And it's just what one of the things that the world needs now.
Okay. Thank you, Fred. Let's go to Elise in Liberty. Elise, hi. You're on the program.
Hi. Thank you for the show. I'm enjoying it. And I guess my question for the author is, in your research, did you probe at all into what motivates what I think is primarily a male phenomenon, this debasement or dehumanization? Certainly women throughout history have had fine examples of this behavior, but it does seem like it's mostly a male behavior. And, you know, what triggers that in the male psyche, and how do we manage that, or how do we, as a society, control that? I'd love to hear his insights into that.
Yeah. David?
I think it would be premature to say it's primarily male. Remember, we're talking about a way of thinking. Now, it's certainly true that males historically have gotten their hands dirty a lot more extensively than females have. That is, they've committed the acts of violence far more frequently than females have. But as a way of thinking about others, I'm not so sure you're right about this. Growing up in the segregated South, I didn't notice in particular any difference in the derogatory attitudes of men and women towards African Americans.
Is it possible, though, that men are simply more prone to acts of violence?
Yes, it's possible.
That's not in the book, though, I guess, right? 1-800, sorry, I lost my place here. 1-800-399-3566. We're taking your calls for David Livingstone Smith. Let's go to Guy in Saco. Guy, hi, go ahead.
Yes. The question I have is, I had read a couple of books that said that in a lot of cases, any genocide, that there was their DNA are the closest. Is it us and them? They kind of isolate them as a them, but typically, in a lot of cases, they're the closest relatives, or the closest in DNA, that they're the Tutsis. And if you go back through history, not all the time, but in a lot of cases, they are.
But there are a lot of cases of these acts against other races who are very close, in fact.
Well, as closest relatives. I mean,
Yeah. I think we need to get away from the DNA idea. I mean, these racial groups are imagined unities. They're not genetically homogenous. But it is very often the case that very similar populations commit horrible acts on one another. It's something that Freud called the narcissism of small differences. We exaggerate the differences that we have with those who are very, very much like us. See, that I would agree with.
Well, as if children spend time together, they tend to be less. It's not an us and them. If it's a Jewish person and a Christian person, or whatever religion it is, if they spend time as children together, that kind of disappears.
To some degree, but remember the example that you mentioned, the Hutus and Tutsis in Rwanda.
Right.
They had very intertwined lives.
Right.
One of the remarkable things about human beings is we're able to extrude others from our community very, very readily, just as we can include others in our community very readily. These boundaries are very, very labile.
Yeah. Guy, thanks for calling. Let's go to Janet in, I believe it's Woolwich. Janet, are you in Woolwich or?
I am in Woolwich.
Woolwich. Ah, the controversy continues. Woolwich or Woolwich? Anyway, go ahead, please.
Hi. Yes, I spent some time in Rwanda, and I'm looking forward to reading your book. In that case, it was not so much animals as the concept of pets. The Hutus referred to the Tutsis as cockroaches. And like Hitler, they used the radio to communicate the message that the cockroaches had to be stamped out literally with one's heel. And, of course, they used machetes to do the job. But it was that degradation, that dehumanization right down to the level of pests. And, of course, in other situations, it's been vermin, rats. And the other example I wanted to point out was, as you mentioned, the American South. When I was there visiting a friend's family in the late 50s, the parents, who were, you know, maybe in their 60s at that time, referred to African Americans as less than human. And I asked them what they meant by that. And the father said, well, they're monkeys. I said, do you really mean that you think they're monkeys? And he said, well, no, they're somewhere between monkeys and humans. That was his worldview. And of course, during slavery, they were referred to as chattel, no more than a piece of wood, a chair, or whatever. And what was interesting to me was that did indeed allow this family to engage in all kinds of exploitation of the African Americans who worked for them, everything from low wages to verbal abuse to, not giving them holidays off and things like that, because after all, they were somewhere between a monkey and a real human being. And I'm struck by the fact that in Mitt Romney's campaign, one of the things that was said about a month ago was he was not really a Christian. So we still do it now in our own ways.
Yeah, I want to let David respond.
Yes, thank you. I have a chapter on genocide in the book, and one of the genocides I discuss is Rwandan genocide. And indeed, the term Inyenzi, cockroach, was used quite a bit. I think that was the most prevalent dehumanizing image in that genocide. There were others. Tutsis were referred to as rats and snakes as well. And Hutus were referred to as hyenas and other sorts of nasty animals, you know, going the other way. The cockroach is, of course, an unclean animal. That's very typical of genocide. Just as in war, the enemy is seen as a dangerous predator, typically a man-eater. In genocide, it's a creature that really needs to be exterminated.
Right, it's not as if there's no guilt about killing it. You, in fact, want to go and eliminate it.
It's an obligation.
Yeah.
Yes. And there's not even the respect that one might grant to a powerful predator. You just want to wipe them out. I also write quite a bit about the dehumanization of African Americans. And, you know, apropos of the things that you describe, I'll remind you and the other listeners that no less than Thomas Jefferson believed that African women had sexual intercourse with apes.
1-800-399-3566 to join the conversation. What happens, David, after maybe someone thinks about, maybe someone has been in a war or has killed another person in the course of war or a genocide, and then begins after the fact to rethink their view, to rehumanize, if you will, do they then start to go through a process of remorse?
Oh, yes, remorse and often psychiatric complications of war. This is something that which is very important to me, actually, and I think is grossly underestimated. In war, men and increasingly women are faced with the need to kill others. It's expected. But in order to do this, particularly to kill people that they have no personal gripe with, they need to overcome these inhibitions. To do this, they need to generally, unless they're sociopaths, create some sort of distance. Now, this could be physical distance through the use of long-range weapons where you're never really directly confronted with the consequences of your act. The epitome would be unmanned drones, which would be like, you know, operating those is like playing a video game. What's more interesting to me, of course, is psychological distance, and dehumanization is one way among many traditional ways of getting psychological distance. But ultimately, it's a form of self-deception, and the reality tends to creep back and haunt one. So people returning from combat really carry very, very heavy psychological and spiritual burdens.
In some ways, isn't it hard for them to let go of the dehumanization?
Well,
because the consequence of that is the...
Well, look, we don't like to recognize that it does violence to us to take the lives of others. We don't even like to recognize that war is about killing. We use these expressions like men giving their lives for their country. Of course, that's ludicrous. No one goes to war saying, shoot me. Lives are taken. They're cruelly taken. And there's an increasing body of literature that shows that the psychiatric complications of combat that we're familiar with in the PTSD industry are strongly correlated with the experience of killing or having killed. And there's even a term for this. It's moral injury. In the past and in other cultures, this was recognized. That is, that before becoming integrated in society, returning combatants had to undergo a process of purification or penance. It was recognized that they suffered from having the stain of blood on their soul. We seem to think that by using some hype about heroism or medical categories like PTSD, which sounds like a case of the flu, sending people off for a little counseling, these really profound issues can be dissipated. We really do our service personnel a great disservice in having that attitude.
1-800-399-3566. Our guest is David Livingstone Smith. The book is Less Than Human. Let's go to Herman and Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hi. Thank you very much for this conversation today. It's been fascinating to listen to. And my question is, regards more, I guess, smaller dehumanization. There's been a lot of talk about a genocide, or you know, the very strong dehumanization of African Americans during racism. And I'm what I'm thinking of is more along the lines of the political speech that is in vogue right now, where in order to achieve some political end, people seem to use speech that dehumanizes the other side or demonizes the other side. We usually use the word demonizes, but it seems to me that it's sort of interchangeable with the way you're using dehumanizes. And I'm thinking mostly of groups. Currently, there have been a lot of attacks, particularly in Maine here, on the unemployed, sometimes injured workers, the poor, and the way that politicians use this language to sort of affect the change that they're looking for strikes me as dehumanization, and I was just interested to hear a comment on that.
Yes, yes. I think you're right that our political discourse often, I would say, at least verges on dehumanization. It's not always clearly involves dehumanization, but this is part of a larger issue, which is the abandonment of the appeal to reason. Politicians try to push our buttons. They try to evoke emotional responses rather than appealing to reason. And unfortunately, increasingly, the American populace becomes less and less capable of rationally examining these attitudes. I see this in my students. And students are often very, very grateful to be taught in a philosophy class some of the skills of reasoning, the importance of reasoning, and critically examining what one is told. So yes, very broadly, I do agree with you, and I think it's a very dangerous trend.
We're going to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions for David Livingstone Smith about his book, Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. Stay with us.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, American drones are everywhere now, down and on display in Tehran, for sale to our allies, even doing law enforcement in the USA. We'll look at drone proliferation. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Join us for On Point tonight at midnight.
On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli joins us to talk about the best and worst TV shows of the year. And our rock critic Ken Tucker does his year-end wrap-up. The year in TV and music on the next Fresh Air.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock.
This is MPB, and I'm Keith Shortall. You're listening to a new program on the Maine Public Broadcasting Network. We invite you to help us name this new show. Send your suggestions to program producer Jonathan Smith. His email is jpsmith@mpbn.net, or post them to our Facebook page. Today, a conversation about the evil that humans sometimes perpetrate on fellow humans. With me in the studio is David Livingstone Smith. He's a philosophy professor at the University of New England and author of the book Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. Share your thoughts on the subject. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Email to talk@mpbn.net or give us a message on our Facebook page. I have an email here from Lori in West Baldwin, who would like to hear Dr. Smith address the changing nature of warfare, and does the ability to kill remotely, for example, by drone aircraft, make it easier to dehumanize the victims?
Yes. Yes, it does. I think this is a very dangerous development, dangerous in its capacity to liberate aggression without concern, dangerous in its facilitating our killing without moral qualm or compunction, because the signals aren't presented that would inhibit our aggression. Of course, there's another side to it, which is it is safer for those who are perpetrating the aggression to kill. I mean, you're not in danger when you're operating an unmanned drone, but it's a development I'm very concerned about, as I am concerned about the increasing use of robots on the battlefield.
Let's go to Sarah in Damariscotta, I believe. Sarah?
Yes. Hi. Thank you very much for taking my phone call. I agree with everything about dehumanization, and it's sad because we've been doing this for centuries, I believe, and we still haven't gotten to a conclusion and what that solution looks like. So my question is, because of getting to this place with war and with women and children and like you talked about PTSD and the aftermath, are you concerned that we have become desensitized to the aftermath of genocide? And the other question is, there is the president from the woman president from Liberia, I believe, and then there's a woman in Yemen that are working with women after they have come out of the battlefield, the young children, what is it that we can do, starting either here in Maine, because we do definitely have some refugees in this state that are going to need some help, but also even at home when there is trauma. I mean, it just trickles down into so many assets, you know, avenues in our lives. So what is it, what is your solution to this problem?
The problem of the aftermath of
well,
genocide?
Any form of dehumanization. I mean, you deal with children that
okay.
have come from.
What do we do about it, I guess? Is
okay.
Yeah, what are we to do about that? I mean, we've got New Hope for Women here in Maine. Is it through education?
Yeah.
Is it through more resources?
Let David respond.
Well, the first thing we need to do, and this will probably sound very disappointing to you, as it did to my editor, is we need to understand it. The fact is there have been hardly any resources devoted to understanding dehumanization. We need to look under the hood and see how it works if we want to understand how to disable this process. That's my first response. Governments and universities and NGOs need to get interested in solving the puzzle of dehumanization. I don't regard my book as the last word on the subject. It's virtually the first word on the subject. So we need a lot more investigation. In terms of the trauma resulting from the perpetration of mass violence, indeed in Maine we have refugees from some of the most hellish places in the world. But I would not, sadly, overestimate the capacity of the mental health profession to deal with these difficulties.
All right, let's go to Bernie in Wellington. Hi, Bernie.
Oh, hi there. Hi, David.
Hi.
I was wondering if you would differ from Bruno Bettelheim in his saying that it's this kind of cruelty and genocide is in all of us. And did he have that first step of first dehumanizing them into animals or whatever?
Philosophy question. Mm.
Yes, it is in all of us, or virtually all of us. There are exceptions to everything. But yes, I think the capacity for dehumanization is a feature of human nature. In fact, it's made possible by our sheer intelligence, our capacity to reflect. To explain that would be a very long story. I mean, it sounds kind of cheap for me to say you would have to read the book. But that's the honest answer.
You have an excuse this time.
I have an excuse this time. But I want to emphasize, this is really important. We tend to dehumanize dehumanizers. We put them at arm's length. We say they're mad or they're monsters. For instance, we say that of the Nazis. They were madmen. Well, they weren't madmen, actually. What's scary about the perpetrators of genocide and the purveyors of war are not that they're unlike us, but it's that they're like us.
Let's go to Sandra in Damariscotta. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
What's your question or comment?
Well, I noticed that, David, you said that the notion of race is the beginning of dehumanization, and we kind of flew off from there. I'm wondering, just as a regular human being, trying not to hurt anybody, what can we do when we see or we suspect dehumanization and this fascination with race come up? What can we do?
Well, one thing that's really helpful in the first place is to learn a little bit about the emptiness of the concept of race. I mean, it's scientifically a vacuous notion. People are very confused about this because they're not taught. In fact, this is another one of my issues. The notion of race is affirmed and reaffirmed and reaffirmed. We're asked to check off little boxes, you know, on forms specifying what race we are. And so people
there's never a place to put to check a human.
No, I write that in.
Oh, good.
I write that in. So we're this illusion of race is hammered into us all the time, and we really need to get away from this. We need to dismantle this notion.
Right. Well, as people keep saying that when good people stand by and do nothing or very little, bad things can happen.
Yes.
What would you advise just regular people to do in their lives.
This doesn't require any, you know, fancy philosophical or scientific insight. What do you, as a moral person, do when you're confronted with something which you think is immoral? You take some sort of stand, in a way, not to persecute the other person, but to try and enlighten them, to try and get them to see things in a way which is more humane.
Sally's on the line from Cumberland. Hi, Sally.
Hi. My question is, have we as human beings lost contact with the divine? If so, why, and how do we reconnect?
Well, you're speaking to an atheist, so it's difficult for me to respond to that in the spirit in which it was intended. And I'll remind you that in many religious writings, including the Bible, genocide is undertaken at the behest of the divine. Have we lost sight? Perhaps let me interpret this in a way which I can make sense of, that I can relate to more. Have we lost sight of what is morally significant for us? Yes, to a great extent we have, but we have throughout history. There was never a time when human beings were these ideal moral beings. In fact, arguably, we treat each other much more humanely now than we have at any point in our previous history.
Let's try to work in one more call here. Robert is calling from Belfast. Hi, Robert.
Yes, this question sort of dovetails with Sally's comment. And could you say a few things, Professor, about the smaller the DNA differences of religious creed and how that enters into making people really want to hurt other people?
Yeah, religion is really important here. It's important because it's very powerful. So some people tend to blame violence and so on religion and say religion is therefore a bad thing. Well, religion does facilitate violence. It also facilitates very good things. The point is that religion allows us to manipulate our own behavior for good or for ill.
Real quickly, let's go to Boothbay and Jean. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead quickly, please.
Yes, I want to ask David Smith believes in humans have evolved and can evolve and will evolve. Many of us believe that those that are different are also more alike. Therefore, the imagining cells of the caterpillar to become a butterfly, we have imagining cells also.
Last comment, David. Can we evolve beyond what we have been?
Well, if we're using the term evolve in the vernacular sense, not in the biological sense, evolution in biology doesn't mean improvement, it just means change. Can we get better? Of course we can. And it's in that spirit that I wrote Less Than Human. I want us to get better, and I think we can.
David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Keith.
David Livingstone Smith, author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. David is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of New England, co-founder and director of the New England Institute for Cognitive Science and Evolutionary Studies. Today's program was produced by Jonathan Smith. John Keimel ran the board. We also had help from Rich Tozier and the MPBN web team. You can listen to this and other new programs by visiting mpbn.net. Click on the radio tab and then click call-in program. I'm Keith Shortall. This is the Maine Public Broadcasting Network.